Listen.
We'll see how it comes out. The air conditioning is getting like two things.
Quiet, please.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to speak to you today. And I'd like to thank the Hans Hofer for being invited to this very beautiful place. Perhaps first I should tell you who I am. It's what I'm going to say depends a great deal upon my personal experience. For many years I worked as a doctor in a hospital, a general hospital in a British slum, and in the prison next door. And the main differences between these two great institutions was that there was far less violence in the prison than in the hospital, and a great deal more laughter. Seems that people prefer to be in prison than in hospital, at least some people. And this isn't for itself without significance. Well, I've retired now, but I still do a little legal work, and which is writing reports for the courts. Recently, I was asked to write and prepare a report on an 18-year-old girl who was living with her 89-year-old great-grandmother, whom, in the traditional fashion, she had attacked. The young woman was, as usual for her, under the influence both of alcohol and cannabis, and she pushed her great-grandmother over, breaking her collarbone. She was living with the great-grandmother because of the breakdown of her relationship with her mother. Of course, there was no father anywhere in sight. And with her grandparents, she had to go to her great-grandmother. But in the course of my examination of her, my interview with her, I asked her whether her mother had ever been in trouble with the police. Yes, she said, what for, I asked. She was on the social, she said. On the social in England means on social security payments, which should really be called out of social. So. She was on the social, and she was working as well. What happened, I asked. Well, she said, she had to give up working. This was said in a completely matter-of-fact way, as if it was self-evident that my question had been a rather foolish one. And a small incident like this, in my view, is very revealing. It tells you something about the worldview of the person concerned, precisely because it is unselfconscious and unguarded. It tells you that this young woman regards it as perfectly normal that the state should be the primary source of a person's income. If you like, being support of the first or first resort rather than of last resort. In the social milieu in which this young woman grew up, it is now regarded as perfectly normal for people to spend their entire lives at the expense of the state, which is, of course, to say, the taxpayers, though the state is now so important in everyone's life that it is seen as something that is just there, like a natural and inescapable feature of the landscape, such as a volcano, more like a volcano than an artifact created and sustained by men. For many of those who live on the state, dependence is actually regarded as the opposite, that is to say, as independence. I worked in a hospital in which, if it had not been for the presence of immigrants from the Indian subcontinent or their descendants, the illegitimacy rate amongst the children born there would have been 100%. To ask the identity of a young person's father had become indelicate or awkward. And many such people would either reply that they had no father, in which case I would suggest that they went up to medical administration straight away to be photographed. Or by saying such things as, do you mean my father at the moment? Which is to say, the adult male member of the household at the moment, who is invariably a bird passage. And now, they actually recently, somebody said,
do you mean my my daddy Nick or my daddy John? Contact with biological fathers was more often than not. And when asked why they were no longer in contact with the fathers of their children, the mothers would say it was because they wanted their independence. By this they meant a complete lack of contact with the people who, one might suppose, would most normally be intimately connected with them, such as their own parents and the father of their child, or more often fathers of their children. It's half siblings. And it was very difficult to tell the generations apart anymore as well. You couldn't assume that if there was an older woman or an oldish woman in her 40s and a youngish woman with a baby, that the baby belonged to the young woman. So independence meant for these women a lack of social ties or any obligations to the people around them. Not independence from the authorities or the state, on which, of course, they were utterly dependent for their food, their clothes, their lodging, their lighting, their heating, their healthcare, education, transport, indeed, absolutely everything that they consumed. And they regarded this as a perfectly normal state of affairs. Well, let me now move on briefly to a remarkable achievement of the British welfare state, its production of more invalids than the First World War. Let me tell you a little story from the ward in the hospital in which I worked to illustrate this point. A young and exceptionally fit, indeed athletic man, was admitted having taken a deliberate overdose. We in Britain take more societal overdoses than any other nation in the world, for reasons which actually we can go to Britain perfectly obvious. I asked him what he did for a living, and he told me that he was on sick and did not work. And I asked him what sickness he had. A bad back, he replied. Now, that he answered in this fashion was in itself remarkable. Most people who are on the sick who are asked this question reply that they get a sick certificate from their doctor. The sick certificate itself being regarded as the illness. Further inquiry into the nature of which is entirely superfluous and meaningless. So you never get out of, they say, what are you on the sick for? And they say, I get a sick. And they say, well, why do you get a sick? Because I'm on the sick. And you never emerge from this, sir. Well, I noticed that this particular young man was perfectly able to get on and off the bed without any sign of pain or disability. A little later in the interview, I always staggered the question so that people didn't realise what I was asking. So that they would don't understand the connection. And incidentally, this man had not worked for 18 months. I asked him what his interests and hobbies were. Martial arts. This is really the first time I've noticed another new medical illness. A back injury that does not permit work, but does permit the practice of martial arts. And he also told me that he went for a jog every night with his bad back. Now, I telephoned his family doctor, his general practitioner, to tell him that, in my opinion, his patient, being a sportsman who had no visible signs of disability, seemed to me to be capable of work. And the family doctor replied, "Oh, I know all that," said, "but the last time I tried to take a sick certificate away from a patient, he picked up the computer and threw it at me." So now I just get sick to which I want one. Now, contrary to what you might suppose, this is not just an amusing anecdote. It is actually emblematic of a mass phenomenon. 50% of British doctors have been assaulted or threatened with assault in the last 12 months. And this creates precisely the atmosphere in which false certification flourishes. Patients have come to expect a 6 certificate, not as a reflection of a genuine illness that they might have, but as an inalienable human right, declaration of independence, so, no, it's true, these are better, etc. And also as a social service to help them out of their current difficulties or to accord with their wishes. Well, approximately 2.5 million adults in Britain are now in receipt of 6 certificates. The great majority of them fraudulent, or at least untruthful. And those in receipt of them are pleased because they no longer have to pretend to look for work as they would if they were unemployed and receive unemployment benefit. And furthermore, sickness benefit is 60% more than unemployment benefit in Britain. So the government is content with this situation because it can claim, and frequently does claim, and it has had its claims accepted. One reads in the French newspapers, for example, an acceptance of this claim, that it has reduced the number of unemployed. Though, in fact, if you add the numbers of supposedly sick to the numbers of unemployed in Britain, the total has not changed very much in the last 20 years. What has changed is the proportion of sick to unemployed. Where once there were far more unemployed than sick, there are now far more sick than unemployed. More than 1 million people are now more or less permanently unemployed because of depression and anxiety alone. Well, the mass phenomenon I have described, in my view, is deeply corrupting. First, it corrupts political debate by allowing the government to assert things that, if not outright lies, are certainly not true. The opposition is reluctant to call these untruths by their name because they know that they are likely to resort to the same, precisely the same untruths and distortions of the truth themselves when they come to power. The medical profession, which ought to be an incorruptible pillar of society, is corrupted because most doctors, most general practitioners, now issue official documents which have practical effect, knowing them to be false. And once you start behaving in this fashion, it reduces your capacity to resist further demands for intellectual, moral, and even financial corruption. Finally, the effects on the recipients of these false sickness notes is harmful as well. If people are certificated sick for long periods, in the end, they will begin to feel sick and to play sick. And this is perfectly natural. They come to inhabit a twilight world in which truth and lies, the line between good and evil as well, in Solzhenitsyn, becomes indistinguishable or so intermixed that nothing is straightforward anymore, and everything then becomes just a game. In short, integrity of any sort becomes impossible for the government, for the opposition, for the medical profession, and a significant part of the population, all of whom come to regard as dissimulation and lying and equivocation as perfectly normal and acceptable strategies in life, indeed as strategies for survival. The twilight world of lies, untruths, and equivocations extends well beyond this particular situation. In the welfare state, there is an incentive for people to present themselves as victims of circumstances, even or perhaps I should say especially, where they have created their circumstances themselves. This is reflected in the language they use and the way in which they talk about their lives. It's very noticeable in the language of criminals, for example. If a man stabs another person to death, he always says, the knife went in. It is the knife that is the active participant in the whole affair. Never mind that he actually took the knife across the city and killed the only person whom he hated. It was still the knife that is the active participant. And I will illustrate what I mean also by reference to drug addiction. I use this example just in the book about Addiction to heroin has become a mass phenomenon in Britain in the last 20 years or so. In the 1950s, when addicts were registered by the Home Office, the Ministry of the Interior, there were known to be about 60 in heroin prison. And while this might be an underestimate, it's unlikely to be wrong by very much. Well, it's now thought that there are about 300,000 heroin addicts in Britain. The entire apparatus of care of such people regards them as being in control of in the grip of an uncontrollable impulse. They did not choose to take heroin in the first place. Their craving for it is so overwhelming that they cannot be expected to resist it. And the consequences of stopping heroin without medical attention are so terrible that no one would be expected to do so. Because such people need, therefore, to take heroin, and heroin costs money, while at the same time destroying their capacity to work, addicts are driven to crime. Now, this is the official, I call it an ideology, an official ideology on which treatment is based, and gun policy is based. Needless to say, all of this is completely and indeed obviously wrong. When an addict says he is hooked by heroin, as he invariably does say to explain his addiction hook, like a fish, he attributes agency to the drug rather than to himself. But the evidence is that most addicts take heroin intermittently for a year before they take it regularly. And furthermore, they live in subcultures in which the consequences of taking the drug are extremely well known, unlike, for example, the dates of the Second World War or any other actual historical fact, or indeed any other fact. You cannot overestimate the effect of the British education system. I used to ask my young patients some questions to find out what they knew. I remember one of the most memorable, good example, was when I asked a chap about 18, what 3 times 4 was. He said, after 11 years of compulsory education, or I should say attendance at school, he said, we didn't get that far. Made me extremely proud of it, that's fair. Anyhow, it would be more true to say that the addict took heroin than the heroin hooked the addict. And one has to choose to be an addict and to work at it. And the state of addiction is not come easily. It is not true that withdrawal from heroin is a serious medical condition. On the contrary, unlike withdrawal from alcohol, which is a potentially serious condition, it is a trivial one. Insofar as the suffering from withdrawal from heroin is real rather than feigned, it is largely the result of anticipatory anxiety, which itself is the consequence of the mythology built up over many years and very assiduously promoted by doctors, social workers, courts, and so forth. The relationship between addiction and crime is not as described. It is not true that addiction to heroin is incompatible with going to work. In the 1930s, for example, most American morphine addicts went to work just like other people. And in fact, have quite often very busy days one way or another. They do actually say, well, I went out to work. Unfortunately, their work is urgent. And therefore, their inability to go to work is not a pharmacological consequence of the drug that they are taking. Addicts who are criminal usually have long criminal records before they ever take heroin. In other words, it is more likely that whatever causes them to become criminal also causes them to become addicts, rather than that their addiction causes them to become criminals. It is not true that medical assistance to stop taking that they need medical assistance to stop taking their drugs. Thousands, indeed millions of addicts have done so without the slightest medical assistance. there is good historical evidence of this. Perhaps the most startling example is that of Mount St. Tully, who was by far the greatest historical terrorist in the history of the world. He said to Adams, if you don't stop, I will shoot you. And when now offered to shoot you, you believe that he meant it. And 20 million people there gave up. Now, this means that there is, in my view, a conceptual difference between rheumatoid arthritis, shall we say, and drug addiction. It would not have made sense for Mao to say, stop having rheumatoid arthritis or I'll shoot you. But it did make sense. I'm not advocating this policy, but it did make sense. It was a logical thing to say. In short, everything that is common knowledge about heroin addiction is wrong. Why is this common knowledge so deeply entrenched in public consciousness then? My answer is that there has been a dialectical relationship between the addicts and the apparatus of care for addicts. They need each other, and I wish I had €1,000 for every addict who would say to me, I would give up if only I had the help. Help which, mysteriously enough, is never forthcoming in sufficient quantities or in precisely the right way. If anything, I would say that the addiction services need the addicts more than the addicts need the services for addicts. Both, however, have a vested interest in presenting addiction as something that just happens to people, as if a person became an addict in the same way that he might contract cancer. In other words, the bureaucracy of care requires a passive population. The passive population knows perfectly well, at some level of its heart and mind, that it is telling lies to itself and to others to obtain supposed benefits that a bureaucracy has to offer, and that it is therefore playing games. For example, the very startling example of this is in prison, which I worked, I would observe prisoners who had just been brought to the prison, supposed addicts, in the waiting room immediately before they came into my consultation room. They would be laughing and joking among themselves. But when they entered my room, they would present themselves as being in the throes of agonizing withdrawal. They would double up with pain and scream. In order that I would prescribe medication for them, which they wanted, but in my view did not need. When I pointed out that moments before they had been laughing and joking, and some of them would laugh and admit that, okay, this time they've been caught out. But others would react with outrage and injured innocence, and it made me wonder really whether it is more difficult to be rightly accused or wrongly accused, which is worse, than I'm not quite sure. Anyhow, although it has been proved experimentally that addicts talk about drugs and addiction to each other in a very different way from how they talk to those who they think might offer them something, usually drugs, to call, no notice is taken of this evidence by those who provide services for addicts. And they provide those services on the assumption that addicts are the helpless playthings of something which is completely beyond their control. And this leads to absurdities that are almost beyond satire. For example, it is now official policy in Britain to give money or goods to addicts in return for their abstinence from drugs, or at least for the provision of urine samples that contain no drugs, which is actually quite another matter, as every experienced doctor knows. And this is the first time in the history of medicine, as far as I know, that bribery has ever been considered a medical treatment in itself. I once suggested satirically that we gave money to burglars as a treatment for the terrible disease of burglary. And one would be able to demonstrate a proper dose response curve. In other words, the more money you gave, the longer they would give out their burglary.
Though absent any medical treatment, there would be failures, because there are burglars who do actually enjoy the burglary in itself. It's a vocation among them. Well, lo and behold, such bribery became official government policy, not with regard to burglars, but with regard to bribes, proving the dictum of my late friend, the economist Peter Bauer, that the only true unemployment these days is among satirists. In the world that we have created, satire is prophecy. I've spoken at length about prohibition because it's a good example, I think one might call it emblematic, of the intellectual corruption that has become so prevalent in our countries, or at least, as I know from experience, in the British Welfare State. Both those who receive benefits and those who go without, instead of the 15% of British households are now receiving direct receipt of money from government, are dependent on lies, dishonesty, half-truths, contradiction, self-deception, play-acting, and so forth, all of which, in my opinion, destroy the human personality. And this is a bad thing, irrespective of the economic effects of such policies. Thank you very much.